distressed Rudi Steiner in the gaps of the crowd. He was calling out. She could see his tortured face and yellow hair. Liesel, get out of there! The book thief did not get out. She closed her eyes and caught the next burning streak, and another, till her body hit the warm flooring of the road. It heated her cheek. More words arrived, this time from the soldier. Steh auf! The economical sentence was directed not to the girl, but the Jew. It was elaborated on. Get up, you dirty asshole! You Jewish whore dog! Get up! Get up! Max hoisted himself upright. Just another push-up, Max. Just another push-up on the cold basement floor. His feet moved. They dragged, and he travelled on. His legs staggered, and his hands wiped at the marks of the whip to soothe the stinging. When he tried to look again for Liesel, the soldier's hands were placed upon his bloodied shoulders and pushed. The boy arrived. His lanky legs crouched, and he called over to his left. Tommy, get out here and help me. We have to get her up. Tommy, hurry! He lifted the book thief by her armpits. Liesel, come on, you have to get off the road. When she was able to stand, she looked at the shocked, frozen-faced Germans, fresh out of their packets. At their feet, she allowed herself to collapse, but only momentarily. A graze struck a match on the side of her face where she'd met the ground. Her pulse flipped it over, frying it on both sides. Far down the road, she could see the blurry legs and heels of the last walking Jew. Her face was burning, and there was a dogged ache in her arms and legs, a numbness that was simultaneously painful and exhausting. She stood one last time. Waywardly, she began to walk and then run down Munich Street to haul in the last steps of Max Vandenberg. Liesel, what are you doing? She escaped the grip of Rudi's words and ignored the watching people at her side. Most of them were mute, statues with beating hearts, perhaps bystanders in the latter stages of a marathon. Liesel cried out again and was not heard. Hair was in her eyes. Please, Max! After perhaps 30 meters, just as a soldier turned around, the girl was felled. Hands were clamped upon her from behind, and the boy next door brought her down. He forced her knees to the road and suffered the penalty. He collected her punches as if they were presents. Her bony hands and elbows were accepted with nothing but a few short moans. He accumulated the loud, clumsy specks of saliva and tears as if they were lovely to his face. And more important, he was able to hold her down. On Munich Street, a boy and girl were entwined. They were twisted and comfortless on the road. Together, they watched the humans disappear. They watched them dissolve, like moving tablets in the humid air. Confessions. When the Jews were gone, Rudi and Liesel untangled, and the book thief did not speak. There were no answers to Rudy's questions. Liesel did not go home, either. She walked forlornly to the train station and waited for her papa for hours. Rudi stood with her for the first 20 minutes, but since it was a good half-day till Hans was due home, he fetched Rosa. On the way back, he told her what had happened, and when Rosa arrived, she asked nothing of the girl. She had already assembled the puzzle, and merely stood beside her, and eventually convinced her to sit down. They waited together. When Papa found out, he dropped his bag, he kicked the Bahnhof air. None of them ate that night. Papa's fingers desecrated the accordion, murdering song after song, no matter how hard he tried. Everything no longer worked. For 3 days, the book thief stayed in bed. Every morning and afternoon, Rudi Steiner knocked on the door and asked if she was still sick. The girl was not sick. On the fourth day, Liesel walked to her neighbor's front door and asked if he might go back to the trees with her, where they'd distributed the bread the previous year. "I should have told you earlier," she said. As promised, they walked far down the road toward Dachau. They stood in the trees. There were long shapes of light and shade. Pine cones were scattered like cookies. "Thank you, Rudy, for everything, for helping me off the road, for stopping me." She said none of it. Her hand leaned on a flaking branch at her side. "Rudy, if I tell you something, will you promise not to say a word to anyone?" "Of course." He could sense the seriousness in the girl's face and the heaviness in her voice. He leaned on the tree next to hers. "What is it? Promise. I did already. Do it again. You can't tell your mother, your brother, or Tommy Müller. Nobody. I promise." Leaning, looking at the ground, she attempted several times to find the right place to start, reading sentences at her feet, joining words to the pine cones and the scraps of broken branches. "Remember when I was injured playing soccer," she said, "out on the street?" It took approximately 3/4 of an hour to explain 2 wars, an accordion, a Jewish fistfighter, and a basement, not forgetting what had happened 4 days earlier on Munich Street. "That's why you went for a closer look," Rudy said, "with the bread that day, to see if he was there."
"Yes."
"Crucified Christ."
"Yes."
The trees were tall and triangular. They were quiet. Liesel pulled the word shaker from her bag and showed Rudy one of the pages. On it was a boy with 3 medals hanging around his throat. "Hair the color of lemons," Rudy read. His fingers touched the words. "You told him about me." At first, Liesel could not talk. Perhaps it was the sudden bumpiness of love she felt for him, or had she always loved him? It's likely. Restricted as she was from speaking, she wanted him to kiss her. She wanted him to drag her hand across and pull her over. It didn't matter where, her mouth, her neck, her cheek, her skin was empty for it, waiting. Years ago, when they'd raced on a muddy field, Rudy was a hastily assembled set of bones with a jagged, rocky smile. In the trees this afternoon, he was a giver of bread and teddy bears. He was a triple Hitler Youth athletics champion. He was her best friend. And he was a month from his death.
"Of course I told him about you," Liesel said.
She was saying goodbye, and she didn't even know it. Ilse Hermann's Little Black Book. In mid-August, she thought she was going to 8 Grandestrasse for the same old remedy. To cheer herself up. That was what she thought. The day had been hot, but showers were predicted for the evening. In The Last Human Stranger, there was a quote near the end. Liesel was reminded of it as she walked past Frau Diller's. "The Last Human Stranger," page 211. "The sun stirs the earth. Around and around it stirs us, like stew." At the time, Liesel only thought of it because the day was so warm. On Munich Street, she remembered the events of the previous week there. She saw the Jews coming down the road, their streams and numbers and pain. She decided there was a word missing from her quote. "The world is an ugly stew," she thought. "It's so ugly, I can't stand it." Liesel crossed the bridge over the Amper River. The water was glorious and emerald and rich. She could see the stones at the bottom and hear the familiar song of water. The world did not deserve such a river. She scaled the hill up to Grandestrasse. The houses were lovely and loathsome. She enjoyed the small ache in her legs and lungs. "Walk harder," she thought, and she started rising like a monster out of the sand. She smelled the neighborhood grass. It was fresh and sweet, green and yellow-tipped. She crossed the yard without a single turn of the head or the slightest pause of paranoia. The window. Hands on the frame. Scissor of the legs. Landing feet. Books and pages. And a happy place. She slid a book from the shelf and sat with it on the floor. Is she home? She wondered. But she did not care if Ilse Hermann was slicing potatoes in the kitchen or lining up in the post office, or standing ghost-like over the top of her, examining what the girl was reading. The girl simply didn't care any more. For a long time, she sat and saw. She had seen her brother die with one eye open, one still in a dream. She had said goodbye to her mother, and imagined her lonely wait for a train back home to oblivion. A woman of wire had laid herself down, her scream travelling the street till it fell sideways like a rolling coin starved of momentum. A young man was hung by a rope made of Stalingrad snow. She had watched a bomber pilot die in a metal case. She had seen a Jewish man who had twice given her the most beautiful pages of her life, marched to a concentration camp. And at the centre of all of it, she saw the Führer shouting his words and passing them around. Those images were the world, and it stewed in her as she sat with the lovely books and their manicured titles. It brewed in her as she eyed the pages full to the brims of their bellies with paragraphs and words. You bastards, she thought, you lovely bastards. Don't make me happy. Please, don't fill me up and let me think that something good can come of any of this. Look at my bruises. Look at this graze. Do you see the graze inside me? Do you see it growing before your very eyes, eroding me? I don't want to hope for anything anymore. I don't want to pray that Max is alive and safe, or Alex Steiner, because the world does not deserve them. She tore a page from the book and ripped it in half. Then a chapter. Soon there was nothing but scraps of words littered between her legs and all around her. The words. Why did they have to exist? Without them, there wouldn't be any of this. Without words, the Führer was nothing. There would be no limping prisoners, no need for consolation or worldly tricks to make us feel better. What good were the words? She said it audibly now to the orange-lit room. What good are the words? The book thief stood and walked carefully to the library door. Its protest was small and half-hearted. The airy hallway was steeped in wooden emptiness. Frau Hermann? The question came back at her and tried for another surge to the front door. It made it only halfway, landing weakly on a couple of fat floorboards. Frau Hermann? The calls were greeted with nothing but silence, and she was tempted to seek out the kitchen for Rudy. She refrained. It wouldn't have felt right to steal food from a woman who had left her a dictionary against a windowpane. That, and she had also just destroyed one of her books, page by page, chapter by chapter. She'd done enough damage as it was. Liesel returned to the library and opened one of the desk drawers. She sat down. The last letter. Dear Mrs. Hermann, as you can see, I have been in your library again, and I have ruined one of your books. I was just so angry and afraid, and I wanted to kill the words. I have stolen from you, and now I've wrecked your property. I'm sorry. To punish myself, I think I will stop coming here. Or is it punishment at all? I love this place, and hate it, because it is full of words. You have been a friend to me, even though I hurt you, even though I have been insufferable, a word I looked up in your dictionary, and I think I will leave you alone now. I'm sorry for everything. Thank you again. Liesel Memminger. She left the note on the desk and gave the room a last goodbye, doing three laps and running her hands over the titles. As much as she hated them, she couldn't resist. Flakes of torn-up paper were strewn around a book called The Rules of Tommy Hoffman. In the breeze from the window, a few of its shreds rose and fell. The light was still orange, but it was not as lustrous as earlier. Her hands felt their final grip of the wooden window frame, and there was the last rush of a plunging stomach and the pang of pain in her feet when she landed. By the time she made it down the hill and across the bridge, the orange light had vanished. Clouds were mopping up. When she walked down Himmel Street, she could already feel the first drops of rain. "I will never see Ilse Hermann again," she thought. But the book thief was better at reading and ruining books than making assumptions. 3 days later, the woman has knocked at number 33 and waits for a reply. It was strange for Liesl to see her without the bathrobe. The summer dress was yellow with red trim. There was a pocket with a small flower on it. No swastikas. Black shoes. Never before had she noticed Ilse Hermann's shins. She had porcelain legs.
"Frau Hermann, I am sorry for what I did the last time in the library."
The woman quieted her. She reached into her bag and pulled out a small black book. Inside was not a story, but lined paper. "I thought, if you're not going to read any more of my books, you might like to write one instead. Your letter, it was..." She handed the book to Liesl with both hands. "You can certainly write. You write well." The book was heavy, the cover matted like the shoulder shrug. "And please," Ilse Hermann advised her, "don't punish yourself like you said you would. Don't be like me, Liesl." The girl opened the book and touched the paper.
"Danke schön, Frau Hermann. I can make you some coffee if you like. Would you come in? I'm home alone. My mama's next door with Frau Holzapfel."
"Shall we use the door or the window?" Liesl suspected it was the broadest smile Ilse Hermann had allowed herself in years.
"I think we'll use the door. It's easier."
They sat in the kitchen. Coffee mugs and bread with jam. They struggled to speak, and Liesl could hear Ilse Hermann swallow, but somehow it was not uncomfortable. It was even nice to see the woman gently blow across the coffee to cool it.
"If I ever write something and finish it," Liesl said, "I'll show you."
"That would be nice." When the mayor's wife left, Liesl watched her walk up Himmel Street. She watched her yellow dress and her black shoes and her porcelain legs. At the mailbox, Rudy asked,
"Was that who I think it was?"
"Yes."
"You're joking."
"She gave me a present."
As it turned out, Ilse Hermann not only gave Liesl Memminger a book that day, she also gave her a reason to spend time in the basement, her favorite place, first with Papa, then Max. She gave her a reason to write her own words, to see that words had also brought her to life.
"Don't punish yourself,"
she heard her say again, but there would be punishment and pain, and there would be happiness too. That was writing. In the night, when Mama and Papa were asleep, Liesl crept down to the basement and turned on the kerosene lamp. For the first hour, she only watched the pencil and paper. She made herself remember, and, as was her habit, she did not look away.
"Schreibe,"
she instructed herself.
"Write."
After more than 2 hours, Liesl Memminger started writing, not knowing how she was ever going to get this right. How could she ever know that someone would pick her story up and carry it with him everywhere? No one expects these things. They don't plan them. She used a small paint can for a seat, a large one as a table, and Liesl stuck the pencil onto the first page. In the middle, she wrote the following. "The Book Thief. A Small Story by Liesl Memminger." The Ribcage Plains. Her hand was sore by page 3. Words are so heavy, she thought, but as the night wore on, she was able to complete 11 pages. Page 1. I try to ignore it, but I know this all started with the train and the snow and my coughing brother. I stole my first book that day. It was a manual for digging graves, and I stole it on my way to Himmel Street.
She fell asleep down there, on a bed of drop sheets, with the paper curling at the edges up on the taller paint can. In the morning, Mama stood above her, her chlorinated eyes questioning.
"Lise," she said, "what on earth are you doing down here?"
"I'm writing, Mama."
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph!"
Rosa stomped back up the steps.
"Be back up in 5 minutes, or you get the bucket treatment. Verstehst?"
"I understand."
Every night, Liesel made her way down to the basement. She kept the book with her at all times. For hours she wrote, attempting each night to complete 10 pages of her life. There was so much to consider, so many things in danger of being left out. Just be patient, she told herself, and with the mounting pages, the strength of her writing fist grew. Sometimes she wrote about what was happening in the basement at the time of writing. She had just finished the moment when Papa had slapped her on the church steps and how they'd Heil Hitler'd together. Looking across, Hans Hubermann was packing the accordion away. He'd just played for half an hour as Liesel wrote. Page 42.
Papa sat with me tonight. He brought the accordion down and sat close to where Max used to sit. I often look at his fingers and face when he plays. The accordion breathes. There are lines on his cheeks. They look drawn on, and for some reason, when I see them, I want to cry. It is not for any sadness or pride. I just like the way they move and change. Sometimes I think my papa is an accordion. When he looks at me and smiles and breathes, I hear the notes.
After 10 nights of writing, Munich was bombed again. Liesel was up to page 102 and was asleep in the basement. She did not hear the cuckoo or the sirens, and she was holding the book in her sleep when Papa came to wake her.
"Liesel, come."
She took the book thief and each of her other books, and they fetched Frau Holzapfel. Page 175. A book floated down the Amper River. A boy jumped in, caught up to it, and held it in his right hand. He grinned. He stood waist-deep in the icy Decemberish water.
"How about a kiss, Saumensch?" he said.
By the next raid, on October the 2nd, she was finished. Only a few dozen pages remained blank, and the book thief was already starting to read over what she'd written. The book was divided into 10 parts, all of which were given the title of books or stories, and described how each affected her life. Often I wonder what page she was up to when I walked down Himmel Street in the dripping tap rain 5 nights later. I wonder what she was reading when the first bomb dropped from the ribcage of a plane. Personally, I like to imagine her looking briefly at the wall, at Max Vandenberg's tightrope cloud, his dripping sun, and the figures walking toward it. Then she looks at the agonizing attempts of her paint-written spelling. I see the Führer coming down the basement steps with his tied-together boxing gloves hanging casually around his neck. And the book thief reads, rereads, and rereads her last sentence for many hours. The book thief, last line.
I have hated the words, and I have loved them, and I hope I have made them right.
Outside, the world whistled. The rain was stained. The End of the World, Part 2. Almost all the words are fading now. The black book is disintegrating under the weight of my travels. That's another reason for telling this story. What did we say earlier? Say something enough times and you never forget it? Also, I can tell you what happened after the book thief's words had stopped, and how I came to know her story in the first place. Like this. Picture yourself walking down Himmel Street in the dark. Your hair is getting wet, and the air pressure is on the verge of drastic change. The first bomb hits Tommy Muller's apartment block. His face twitches innocently in his sleep, and I kneel at his bed. Next, his sister. Christina's feet are sticking out from under the blanket. They match the hopscotch footprints on the street. Her little toes. Their mother sleeps a few feet away. Four cigarettes sit disfigured in her ashtray, and the roofless ceiling is hot plate red. Himmel Street is burning. The sirens began to howl. "Too late now," I whispered, for that little exercise, because everyone had been fooled and fooled again. First up, the Allies had feigned a raid on Munich in order to strike at Stuttgart. But next, 10 planes had remained. Oh, there were warnings, all right. In Mulking, they came with the bombs. A roll call of streets. Munich, Ellenberg, Johansson, Himmel. The main street, plus 3 more, in the poorer part of town. In the space of a few minutes, all of them were gone. A church was chopped down. Earth was destroyed, where Max Vandenberg had stayed on his feet. At 31 Himmel Street, Frau Holzapfel appeared to be waiting for me in the kitchen. A broken cup was in front of her, and in a last moment of awakeness, her face seemed to ask just what in the hell had taken me so long. By contrast, Frau Diller was fast asleep. Her bulletproof glasses were shattered next to the bed. Her shop was obliterated, the counter landing across the road, and her framed photo of Hitler was taken from the wall and thrown to the floor. The man was positively mugged and beaten to a glass-shattering pulp. I stepped on him on my way out. The Fiedlers were well organized, all in bed, all covered. Pfiffikus was hidden up to his nose. At the Steiners, I ran my fingers through Barbara's lovely combed hair. I took the serious look from Kurt's serious sleeping face, and one by one, I kissed the smaller ones good night. Then, Rudy. Oh, crucified Christ. Rudy. He lay in bed with one of his sisters. She must have kicked him or muscled her way into the majority of the bed space, because he was on the very edge with his arm around her. The boy slept. His candlelit hair ignited the bed, and I picked both him and Bettina up with their souls still in the blanket. If nothing else, they died fast, and they were warm. The boy from the plane, I thought. The one with the teddy bear. Where was Rudy's comfort? Where was someone to alleviate this robbery of his life? Who was there to soothe him, as life's rug was snatched from under his sleeping feet? No one. There was only me. And I'm not too great at that sort of comforting thing, especially when my hands are cold and the bed is warm. I carried him softly through the broken street, with one salty eye and a heavy, deathly heart. With him, I tried a little harder. I watched the contents of his soul for a moment, and saw a black-painted boy calling the name Jesse Owens as he ran through an imaginary tape. I saw him hip-deep in some icy water, chasing a book, and I saw a boy lying in bed, imagining how a kiss would taste from his glorious next-door neighbor. He does something to me, that boy. Every time, it's his only detriment. He steps on my heart. He makes me cry. Lastly, the Hubermans. Hans. Papa. He was tall in the bed, and I could see the silver through his eyelids. His soul sat up. It met me. Those kinds of souls always do, the best ones. The ones who rise up and say, "I know who you are, and I am ready. Not that I want to go, of course, but I will come." Those souls are always light, because more of them have been put out. More of them have already found their way to other places. This one was sent out by the breath of an accordion, the odd taste of champagne in summer, and the art of promise-keeping. He lay in my arms and rested. There was an itchy lung for a last cigarette, and an immense magnetic pull toward the basement, for the girl who was his daughter, and was writing a book down there that he hoped to read one day. Liesl. His soul whispered it as I carried him. But there was no Liesl in that house. Not for me, anyway. For me, there was only a Rosa. And yes, I truly think I picked her up mid-snore, for her mouth was open, and her papery pink lips were still in the act of moving. If she'd seen me, I'm sure she would have called me a Zaukerl, though I would not have taken it badly. After reading The Book Thief, I discovered that she called everyone that. Zaukerl, Zaumensch, especially the people she loved. Her elastic hair was out. It rubbed against the pillow, and her wardrobe body had risen with the beating of her heart. Make no mistake, the woman had a heart. She had a bigger one than people would think. There was a lot in it, stored up, high in miles of hidden shelving. Remember that she was the woman with the instrument strapped to her body in the long moonslit night. She was a Jew feeder without a question in the world on a man's first night in Malking. And she was an arm reacher, deep into a mattress, to deliver a sketchbook to a teenage girl. The Last Luck. I moved from street to street and came back for a single man named Schultz at the bottom of Himmel. He couldn't hold out inside the collapsed house, and I was carrying his soul up Himmel Street when I noticed the LSE shouting and laughing. There was a small valley in the mountain range of rubble. The hot sky was red and turning. Pepper streaks were starting to swirl, and I became curious. Yes, yes, I know what I told you at the beginning. Usually my curiosity leads to the dreaded witnessing of some kind of human outcry. But on this occasion, I have to say that although it broke my heart, I was, and still am, glad I was there. When they pulled her out, it's true that she started to wail and scream for Hans Hubermann. The men of the LSE attempted to keep her in their powdery arms, but the book thief managed to break away. Desperate humans often seem able to do this. She did not know where she was running, for Himmel Street no longer existed. Everything was new and apocalyptic. Why was the sky red? How could it be snowing? And why did the snowflakes burn her arms? Liesl slowed to a staggering walk and concentrated up ahead. Where's Frau Dillers? She thought. Where's... She wandered a short while longer until the man who found her took her arm and kept talking. You're just in shock, my girl. It's just shock. You're going to be fine. What's happened? Liesl asked. Is this still Himmel Street? Yes. The man had disappointed eyes. What had he seen these past few years? This is Himmel. You got bombed, my girl. Es tut mir leid, Schatzi. I'm sorry, darling. The girl's mouth wandered on, even if her body was now still. She had forgotten her previous wails for Hans Hubermann. That was years ago. A bombing will do that. She said, We have to get my papa, my mama, we have to get Max out of the basement. If he's not there, he's in the hallway, looking out the window. He does that sometimes when there's a raid. He doesn't get to look much at the sky, you see. I have to tell him how the weather looks now. He'll never believe me. Her body buckled at that moment, and the LSE man caught her and sat her down. We'll move her in a minute, he told his sergeant. The book thief looked at what was heavy and hurting in her hand. The book. The words. Her fingers were bleeding, just like they had on her arrival here. The LSE man lifted her and started to lead her away. A wooden spoon was on fire. A man walked past with a broken accordion case, and Liesl could see the instrument inside. She could see its white teeth and the black notes in between. They smiled at her and triggered an alertness to her reality. We were bombed, she thought, and now she turned to the man at her side and said, That's my papa's accordion. Again, that's my papa's accordion.
Don't worry, young girl, you're safe. Just come a little farther.
But Liesl did not come. She looked to where the man was taking the accordion and followed him. With the red sky still showering its beautiful ash, she stopped the tall LSE worker and said,
I'll take that if you like. It's my papa's.
Softly, she took it from the man's hand and began carrying it off. It was right about then that she saw the first body. The accordion case fell from her grip. The sound of an explosion. Frau Holzapfel was scissored on the ground. The next dozen seconds of Liesl Memminger's life. She turns on her heel and looks as far as she can down this ruined canal that was once Himmel Street. She sees two men carrying a body, and she follows them. When she saw the rest of them, Liesl coughed. She listened momentarily as a man told the others that they had found one of the bodies in pieces in one of the maple trees. There were shocked pajamas and torn faces. It was the boy's hair she saw first. Rudy? She did more than mouth the word now. Rudy? He lay with yellow hair and closed eyes, and the book thief ran toward him and fell down. She dropped the black book. Rudy, she sobbed, wake up! She grabbed him by his shirt and gave him just the slightest disbelieving shake. Wake up, Rudy! And now, as the sky went on heating and showering ash, Liesl was holding Rudy Steiner's shirt by the front. Rudy, please! The tears grappled with her face. Rudy, please wake up! God damn it, wake up! I love you! Come on, Rudy! Come on, Jesse Owens! Don't you know I love you? Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! But nothing cared. The rubble just climbed higher. Concrete hills with caps of red. A beautiful, tear-stomped girl shaking the dead. Come on, Jesse Owens! But the boy did not wake. In disbelief, Liesl buried her head into Rudy's chest. She held his limp body, trying to keep him from lolling back, until she needed to return him to the butchered ground. She did it gently. Slow, slow.
God, Rudy!
She leaned down and looked at his lifeless face, and Liesl kissed her best friend, Rudy Steiner, soft and true, on his lips. He tasted dusty and sweet. He tasted like regret in the shadows of trees and in the glow of the anarchist's suit collection. She kissed him long and soft, and when she pulled herself away, she touched his mouth with her fingers. Her hands were trembling, her lips were fleshy, and she leaned in once more, this time losing control and misjudging it. Their teeth collided on the demolished world of Himmel Street. She did not say goodbye. She was incapable, and after a few more minutes at his side, she was able to tear herself from the ground. It amazes me what humans can do, even when streams are flowing down their faces, and they stagger on, coughing and searching, and finding. The next discovery, the bodies of Mama and Papa, both lying tangled in the gravel bedsheet of Himmel Street. Liesl did not run, or walk, or move at all. Her eyes had scoured the humans, and stopped hazily when she noticed the tall man and the short wardrobe woman. That's my mama. That's my papa. The words were stapled to her.
They're not moving, she said quietly. They're not moving.
Perhaps, if she stood still long enough, it would be they who moved, but they remained motionless for as long as Liesl did. I realized at that moment that she was not wearing any shoes. What an odd thing to notice right then. Perhaps I was trying to avoid her face, for the book thief was truly an irretrievable mess. She took a step and didn't want to take any more, but she did. Slowly, Liesel walked to her mamma and papa and sat down between them. She held mamma's hand and began speaking to her.
"Remember when I came here, mamma? I clung to the gate and cried. Do you remember what you said to everyone on the street that day?"
Her voice wavered now.
"You said, 'What are you assholes looking at?'"
She took mamma's hand and touched her wrist.
"Mamma, I know that you... I liked when you came to school and told me Max had woken up. Did you know I saw you with Papa's accordion?"
She tightened her grip on the hardening hand.
"I came and watched, and you were beautiful. God damn it, you were so beautiful, Mama."
Many moments of avoidance. Papa. She would not and could not look at Papa. Not yet. Not now. Papa was a man with silver eyes, not dead ones. Papa was an accordion, but his bellows were all empty. Nothing went in, and nothing came out. She began to rock back and forth. A shrill, quiet, smearing note was caught somewhere in her mouth, until she was finally able to turn to Papa. At that point, I couldn't help it. I walked around to see her better, and from the moment I witnessed her face again, I could tell that this was who she loved the most. Her expression stroked the man on his face. It followed one of the lines down his cheek. He had sat in the washroom with her and had taught her how to roll a cigarette. He gave bread to a dead man on Munich Street and told the girl to keep reading in the bomb shelter. Perhaps if he didn't, she might not have ended up writing in the basement. Papa, the accordionist, and Himmel Street. One could not exist without the other, because for Liesel, both were home. Yes, that's what Hans Hubermann was for Liesel Memminger. She turned around and spoke to the LSE.
"Please," she said, "my papa's accordion. Could you get it for me?"
After a few minutes of confusion, an older member brought the Eton case, and Liesel opened it. She removed the injured instrument and laid it next to Papa's body.
"Here, Papa.
And I can promise you something, because it was a thing I saw many years later, a vision in the book thief herself, that as she knelt next to Hans Hubermann, she watched him stand and play the accordion. He stood and strapped it on in the Alps of broken houses and played the accordion with kindness silver eyes and even a cigarette slouched on his lips. He even made a mistake and laughed in lovely hindsight. The bellows breathed and the tall man played for Liesel Memminger one last time, as the sky was slowly taken from the stove. "Keep playing, Papa." Papa stopped. He dropped the accordion, and his silver eyes continued to rust. There was only a body now, on the ground, and Liesel lifted him up and hugged him. She wept over the shoulder of Hans Hubermann.
"Goodbye, Papa. You saved me. You taught me to read. No one can play like you. I'll never drink champagne. No one can play like you."
Her arms held him. She kissed his shoulder. She couldn't bear to look at his face anymore. And she placed him down again. The book thief wept till she was gently taken away. Later, they remembered the accordion, but no one noticed the book. There was much work to be done. And with a collection of other materials, the book thief was stepped on several times and eventually picked up without even a glance and thrown aboard a garbage truck. Just before the truck left, I climbed quickly up and took it in my hand. It's lucky I was there. Then again, who am I kidding? I'm in most places at least once. And in 1943... I was just about everywhere. Epilogue, The Last Colour. Featuring Death and Liesel, some wooden tears, Max, and the Handover Man. Death and Liesel. It has been many years since all of that, but there is still plenty of work to do. I can promise you that the world is a factory. The sun stirs it, the humans rule it. And I remain. I carry them away. As for what's left of this story, I will not skirt around any of it, because I'm tired. I'm so tired. And I will tell it as straightly as I can. A last fact. I should tell you that the book thief died only yesterday. Liesel Memminger lived to a very old age, far away from Malking and the demise of Himmel Street. She died in a suburb of Sydney. The house number was 45, the same as the Fiedler's shelter, and the sky was the best blue of afternoon. Like her papa, her soul was sitting up. In her final visions, she saw her three children, her grandchildren, her husband, and the long list of lives that merged with hers. Among them, lit like lanterns, were Hans and Rosa Huberman, her brother, and the boy whose hair remained the colour of lemons forever. But a few other visions were there as well. Come with me, and I'll tell you a story. I'll show you something. Wood in the Afternoon. When Himmel Street was cleared, Liesel Memminger had nowhere to go. She was the girl they referred to as the one with the accordion, and she was taken to the police, who were in the throes of deciding what to do with her. She sat on a very hard chair. The accordion looked at her through the hole in the case. It took 3 hours in the police station for the mayor and a fluffy-haired woman to show their faces. "Everyone says there's a girl," the lady said, "who survived on Himmel Street." A policeman pointed. Ilse Herrmann offered to carry the case, but Liesel held it firmly in her hand as they walked down the police station steps. A few blocks down Munich Street, there was a clear line separating the bombed from the fortunate. The mayor drove. Ilse sat with her in the back. The girl let her hold her hand on top of the accordion case, which sat between them. It would have been easy to say nothing, but Liesel had the opposite reaction to her devastation. She sat in the exquisite spare room of the mayor's house and spoke to herself well into the night. She ate very little. The only thing she didn't do at all was wash. For 4 days, she carried around the remains of Himmel Street on the carpets and floorboards of 8 Gründerstrasse. She slept a lot and didn't dream, and on most occasions she was sorry to wake up. Everything disappeared when she was asleep. On the day of the funerals, she still hadn't bathed, and Ilse Herrmann asked politely if she'd like to. Previously, she'd only shown her the bath and given her a towel. People who were at the service of Hans and Rosa Huberman always talked about the girl who stood there wearing a pretty dress and a layer of Himmel Street dirt. There was also a rumour that later in the day she walked fully clothed into the Amper River and said something very strange. Something about a kiss. Something about a Saumensch. How many times did she have to say goodbye? After that, there were weeks and months and a lot of war. She remembered her books in the moments of worst sorrow, especially the ones that were made for her and the one that saved her life. One morning, in a renewed state of shock, she even walked back down to Himmel Street to find them, but nothing was left. There was no recovery from what had happened. That would take decades. It would take a long life. There were 2 ceremonies for the Steiner family. The first was immediately upon their burial. The second was as soon as Alex Steiner made it home, when he was given leave after the bombing. Since the news had found him, Alex had been whittled away.
"Crucified Christ," he'd said. "If only I'd let Rudy go to that school."
You save someone, you kill them. How was he supposed to know? The only thing he truly did know was that he'd have done anything to have been on Himmel Street that night, so that Rudy survived rather than himself. That was something he told Liesl on the steps of 8 Gründerstrasse when he rushed up there after hearing of her survival. That day, on the steps, Alex Steiner was sawn apart. Liesl told him that she had kissed Rudy's lips. It embarrassed her, but she thought he might have liked to know. There were wooden teardrops and an oaky smile. In Liesl's vision, the sky I saw was grey and glossy. A silver afternoon. Max. When the war was over, and Hitler had delivered himself to my arms, Alex Steiner resumed work in his tailor shop. There was no money in it, but he busied himself there for a few hours each day, and Liesl often accompanied him. They spent many days together, often walking to Dachau after its liberation, only to be denied by the Americans. Finally, in October 1945, a man with swampy eyes, feathers of hair, and a clean-shaven face walked into the shop. He approached the counter. "Is there someone here by the name of Liesl Memminger?"
"Yes, she's in the back," said Alex.
He was hopeful, but he wanted to be sure.
"May I ask who is calling on her?"
Liesl came out. They hugged and cried and fell to the floor. The Handover Man. Yes, I have seen a great many things in this world. I attend the greatest disasters and work for the greatest villains. But then, there are other moments. There's a multitude of stories, a mere handful, as I have previously suggested, that I allow to distract me as I work, just as the colours do. I pick them up in the unluckiest, unlikeliest places, and I make sure to remember them as I go about my work. The Book Thief is one such story. When I travelled to Sydney and took Liesl away, I was finally able to do something I'd been waiting on for a long time. I put her down, and we walked along Anzac Avenue near the soccer field, and I pulled a dusty black book from my pocket. The old woman was astonished. She took it in her hand and said, "Is this really it?" I nodded. With great trepidation, she opened The Book Thief and turned the pages. I can't believe. Even though the text had faded, she was able to read her words. The fingers of her soul touched the story that was written so long ago in her Himmel Street basement. She sat down on the curb, and I joined her. "Did you read it?" she asked, but she did not look at me. Her eyes were fixed to the words. I nodded. "Many times." "Could you understand it?" And at that point, there was a great pause. A few cars drove by, each way. Their drivers were Hitlers and Hubermans, and Maxes, Killers, Dillers, and Steiners. I wanted to tell the book thief many things about beauty and brutality. But what could I tell her about those things that she didn't already know? I wanted to explain that I am constantly overestimating and underestimating the human race. That rarely do I ever simply estimate it. I wanted to ask her how the same thing could be so ugly and so glorious, and its words and stories so damning and brilliant. None of those things, however, came out of my mouth. All I was able to do was turn to Liesl Memminger and tell her the only truth I truly know. I said it to the book thief, and I say it now to you. A last note from your narrator. I am haunted by humans. This is Alan Corduna. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak. This program was produced and directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Uli Moskowitz. Text copyright 2006 by Marcus Zusak. Production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment, it's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Thank you, and happy listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.